Welcome to the Game History Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. My guest this week is Cheryl Head, but before we begin the interview, we're going to have our regular weekly book recommendation from Justine. Hey, Justine.
Hey, Brad, how you doing?
Life is great.
Yeah, it's warmed up here in Southern California, and, at least for me, it's fine.
Well, it's fine. You know, this is still when COVID-19 is going on, and I'm really sick of being home, but maybe I can get some cleaning done.
Yeah, I've been saying that for 4 months.
I have too.
At some point, it's like, oh, forget it. I'll just keep the laundry in the basket.
So what you got for us today?
I have a J.B. Sanders book, Glenn and Tyler's Saratoga Trunk. And Glenn and Tyler are a married couple. He's got 5 books in the series. The first 4 are all spy adventures, and book 5 is the first mystery. So it is book 5 that I'm recommending today. However, as an aside, the first 4 are quite fun also, even though they're not mysteries. They are all more of a caper. They're not very serious mysteries. They're really a lot of fun. In the first book, Tyler, who is a part of the richest family in the world, is supposed to get married before he's 25 in order to inherit. And he and his best friend, Glenn, are both ostensibly straight, and they end up getting married. But it turns out that, they're really hot for each other. And by book 5, that all is a distant memory. And here we are. Tyler is rich beyond their wildest dreams. Glenn, being married to him, is also rich. Tyler's business card says, Tyler Conrad, I own things. So at the beginning of book 5, there starts out with a little spying. They're having lunch in a cafe in New Orleans, and somebody comes by with a little spy mission. And then after that, there's the usual showing off of how wealthy they are. And they're so wealthy that they own an airship. And if it sounds like a wealthy gay couple is kind of familiar and it's reminiscent of Frank Butterfield's Nick and Carter books, well, J.B. Sanders is actually the inspiration for Frank's books.
Okay, I was thinking it sounded familiar.
Sounds familiar, and they were the inspiration for Frank's books. But Frank's books do not have an airship. And, an airship is like the old-fashioned blimp-type thing where it's like it's round and you're sitting inside like a luxury cruise ship for people who don't like flying like Glenn.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what era is this?
It's the modern era, but they have revamped an old airship.
Oh, well,
and they own 2 airships that they have revamped from the original airship. I mean, and this book does not have enough of the airship in it. So it's my favorite character in the series, so to speak. Anyway, they also have their own hockey teams. At some point, one of them bought a hockey team and the other bought a different hockey team. And there was a whole side story about the NHL complaining about them not having 2 teams. And they just paid off the NHL and got to keep their 2 teams. So in this book, their college where they met is going under, and they call Tyler to make a donation, and he comes up with a $2 billion donation, but he's kind of flying into town to present it himself. They walk by this old house where they had walked by when they were poor college students and always dreamed of living in, and Tyler buys it, and 3 days later, they move in, and he tells Glenn the day before they move in, and he surprises him with it. So here's this old house that they want to live in, and there are lots of dusty boxes and trunks in the attic. Glenn, who has a doctorate in medieval artifact, is up there conducting his own form of an archaeological search and discovers a body in one of their trunks.
That was going to be my guess.
I was going to be your guess, yeah. And there's some amusing thing where the police commissioner comes and he says, judging by the dust, it's been there a while. And he says, oh, you have a lot of experience with dusty things. He says, yes, this is what I have a doctorate in. And I was conducting the whole thing like an archaeological dig, going through each item. And I didn't quite get to that trunk, because it was a different era and I was going through methodically, and that's why I didn't find the trunk the day we moved in. So they set out to solve this mystery. They have a very large security force, and a couple of the security guards, including the head of security, are in there as regular characters. Tyler's grandmother, Nana, is a feisty old woman, swears a lot, you know, while she's somewhat disabled, never lets that stop her. They've also got a very rich friend, Rebecca Sterling, who decides to show up and hang out because life is always more interesting with them, and then she gets pulled into the mystery too. The whole thing gets a delightful recommendation. I really enjoyed this book.
Delightful's fun.
Yeah, and it's a caper.
Capers are fun as well. That's what makes it delightful.
Yeah, and as the heat comes in and summer days are long, this is a great beach read. And if you're not going to the beach and just pretending on your back porch, then, you know, it works there too.
Well, we have quite a few listeners in Australia, so they're stuck at home during the cold evenings.
Okay. Good fireside reading.
<There you go.
laughs> They've got an old house. The heat is broken, and so it's a little cool, and that part of it will appeal to those sitting at home, thankful their own heat is working.
And then you have some news regarding Requeer Tales.
Well, your guest Cheryl Head today has just agreed to write the foreword for the third book in Nikki Baker's Virginia Kelly series. Requeer Tales is bringing back the trilogy. Nikki Baker was the first African-American author of the first African-American lesbian mysteries. And we brought out all three, and Cheryl's now agreed to write the foreword for the third book.
I'm not surprised, because Cheryl, talking with her was as delightful as the book you just recommended.
Yep, I think it's going to be a great combination.
All right, Justine, we'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
If you enjoy Gay Mystery Podcast, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. Cheryl Head spent 20 years in public television and radio before turning to fiction writing. Her award-winning first novel, Long Way Home, is a story of the experience of Black soldiers in America's segregated wartime army and features two Black gay men. She writes the Charlie Mack Motown Mysteries, whose female PA protagonist is queer and Black. Cheryl is director of inclusion at the Golden Crown Literary Society. Welcome, Cheryl. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, the pleasure's mine, Brad. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're welcome. Your intro says that you are the director of inclusion at the Golden Crown Literary Society.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the organization and what the mission is?
Absolutely. So the Golden Crown Literary Society's mission is to promote and recognize and educate readers about quality lesbian-themed and women-loving women. Fiction. It's an organization that's been around since 2004. We have an annual conference. We have a writing academy that is a intense craft-driven learning experience. So we have 10 or 12 students in that academy every year. We also do a monthly book club, and we have a variety of membership benefits. We have about a 600 member organization right now, and we're right on the precipice of new growth.
Sounds like awesome, an organization.
It's improving every year. I got involved about 5 years ago and got on the board the following year. They brought me in to do some work on diversity. It's an organization that really takes inclusion and diversity seriously. Has a long way to go, a lot of work to do, because doing this diversity work really is a marathon and not a sprint, because it happens in fits and starts. And attracting people to come into an organization requires that you have programs and services that really can benefit them. So they really have to see the benefit of coming into an organization and feel welcome. And we're working on that every single day.
Well, speaking of diversity, why is diversity so important specifically in this genre?
Well, it's a new time, Brad. I grew up reading mysteries. I grew up reading, white male writers writing mysteries. And I love that genre. I love noir, and I still do. It's a guilty pleasure of mine to read something like a Lauren Estelman or the other writers of the 50s. But we have so many readers who expect to see themselves in our fiction. We have so many different points of view that deserve to be heard by the fans of mystery and crime and thriller novels. I think we bring new insights. Writers of colors bring new insights, certainly new points of view and character-driven fiction that you just won't find in the genre now. And I think it's an industry and an enterprise that's big enough for all of us. And I think it will just be better the more inclusion we have of all the voices, ethnic voices and queer voices and all the voices that make up the community.
I couldn't agree with you more. Now, do you find inclusion in crime drama different than other genres?
That's a really interesting question. Yeah, I guess I do. and it's because, the protagonists are often these archetypical, solitary, white males, no real family, loners, sort of like the cowboy archetype. And I think that what we're seeing with the mystery fiction that's coming from crime writers of color is a whole new take on who that protagonist can be. I was thinking about this, even as early as a couple years ago when I did a panel about diversity at VoucherCon. So there's these great writers who have written about the LA experience, but now we have Walter Mosley, and now we have Steph Cha, and we have Naomi Hirahara, and we have lots of other people who can bring a new perspective to what that LA crime thriller genre can be. I love Chinatown, but I also love Steph Cha's new work, and your work is Los Angeles based, isn't it, Brad?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Yep, it's. I'm not a native of LA, but I have adopted it as my home and
absolutely
embraced it in my novels.
And I appreciate your stories and those stories that are different than the ones, those kind of classic look at the PI tropes and the PI take on things that started in the 50s.
Well, what I want you to do is turn on your crystal ball, and you've kind of answered this with your organization, but how do you view the future for more inclusion in crime fiction?
Yeah. What I think is that the organizations that support crime fiction, the ones that give awards, the ones that have the big conferences, are changing and embracing the fact that there is a new cadre of LGBTQ and other writers of color, crime writers of color. I think, it's hard to change, but I do see them changing in slow and painful ways, sometimes with a lot of drama, sometimes with a lot of scandal. But I think it's going to change. I think our readers are going to demand it. I think the reading public will demand to see diversity in the fiction that comes through the publishing houses, both the Big Five and the smaller indie publishing houses. So I'm feeling optimistic about it. And because I'm a little bit older than some of the Black Lives Matter youngsters, I've been waiting for it for a while, and I'm happy to see the change. And I think it's going to come. I don't think we'll have to wait much longer for it.
Yeah, I can tell you my gut feeling from seeing what I see in social media. I see a demand for it. And
yes, absolutely a demand. And finally, an acceptance of the demand.
Yes, I agree. So let's get to your book.
Okay.
Find Me When I'm Lost is your fifth Charlie Mack mystery.
That's right.
And it comes out this month and is currently available on pre-order.
That's correct.
Tell us who Charlie Mack is.
Well, Charlie is an interesting character for me. She's an African-American bisexual private investigator who comes to the private investigation work via law and via agent, being an agent at the, Homeland Security. She's ambitious. She's owned lots of businesses in her 34 years on the earth. She grew up in Detroit with a mother who's a principal of a high school, so she felt during her whole school years through high school that she was pretty restricted in what she could do. So she kind of went buck wild in college, played out some of her flaws in college, I'd say. And in the beginning of the series, she is just really kind of finding herself as a queer person. She's avoided the labels about being queer and didn't want to be called bisexual, although she is. And as the series moves forward, she has decided to select the love of her life, which is a woman, Mandy Porter. She's a complex character. She has a lot of empathy. She has kind of an innate intelligence about things. She can see things in a slightly different way than other people, and that helps her to suss out the clues and to solve the crimes and to get the bad guys to reveal themselves.
Well, I got to tell you, I saw a review today for Find Me When I'm Lost.
Yeah.
And it was in the lesbian book blog.
Oh, yeah. That was a good review.
What really stood out to me is it said, you are a writer in complete control of your craft.
Wow.
That really stands out. Can you tell us a bit about Find Me When I'm Lost?
Yes. So in this fifth book, Charlie is at home late at night. She gets a call on the phone, and the phone call is from her ex-husband's new wife. She's never met the woman, has never talked to the woman, and she calls because she's in trouble, and Franklin, her ex, is in trouble. He has been charged with the murder of the wife's brother. He's on the lam, and the new wife is distraught because she knows, like herself, that Charlie will know that Franklin is innocent. And thus begins the investigation to both find her ex-husband and to clear his name of this crime.
Now, you mentioned that Charlie taken on a lover or a partner.
Yes.
How and what other ways has Charlie changed since book one?
Great question. She has become more comfortable being a queer woman. Detroit, the Black community in Detroit, I grew up there. I haven't lived there in 20 plus years, but when I was there, there was a lot of curiosity about being queer, but people always wouldn't call themselves that. So there was a lot of down low going on in Detroit at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's not unusual for a city like Detroit that is both large and parochial at the same time. In particular, the Black community hasn't always embraced the gay lifestyle. That's clearly still true today in some sectors. The Black church certainly put a burden on Black queer people in Detroit. And so through the course of the five books, Charlie has become more comfortable in her skin as a queer woman. You know, she's come out to her mother. She's selected a new love. She presents herself as she is. And I like that about her. I like that she is learning about herself and feeling really comfortable about herself.
Well, I know here in LA, there's still communities where large segments are still on the down low.
Yes.
So.
In this day and age, I mean, but for some of us of a certain age, you know, there was so much ostracism and there was some danger for some people, depending on what communities you were in. So I like to tell the young ones, they don't know how lucky they have it, that they can just be out and queer and cheerful and doing the parades and just being comfortable being who they are. It's a great way to be.
Yeah. I grew up in the South, so I didn't come out till I was 35.
Wow. Yeah.
And it amazed me when I was asked to speak at a local high school to the Gay Straight Alliance, because I'm like, this would never have happened at my high school.
Okay.
It just blew my mind. And the questions you asked were tremendous.
Excellent, Brad. Wow.
What are some of the challenges you face writing a series and having growth like Charlie had?
Well, I think one of the challenges is I want to have a broad audience for the series. I'm writing in what's called the lesfic genre. It's a subset of the broader mystery community. And so I publish with in a small publisher, Bywater Books, very high quality stuff, very great people who work there. They give me a lot of support around my books. But I want to make sure those books have a broad readership. And so that's why I'm involving myself in a real way with the mystery and crime community to get in front of both readers, but also the publishing leaders about the value of the books that can come out of smaller presses and come out of Lesfic in my case.
Now, you spent 20 years in television and film before becoming a fiction author.
Yes.
What prompted that change?
Well, what really prompted the change is I was working at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and it's a quasi-federal agency whose president is selected by the president of the United States. And so at the time, my final years there, George W. Bush was the president of the United States, and we had a new group of Republicans who came in and made the work different and hard and not fair, in my opinion, in some ways. And so I thought, okay, this seems like a time to do my own thing. I've always been a storyteller. I've funded storytellers. I like the fact that our voices need to be heard. I was doing some real good work there, and I made some real efforts to promote LGBTQ producers and, of course, producers in all of our minority communities, Native American and African American and Asian American and Pacific Islanders. But it got harder to do the work because there was just so much kind of suppression of spending public tax dollars in a fair and equitable way. So I took an early retirement, and my catharsis for doing that was to start writing fiction immediately. And I brought that, my storytelling skills, to a new genre, and it was tough at first. It was flexing all new muscles, but I'm really enjoying learning as I go. And so to get a review that says I'm a master of my craft, I don't feel like I'm quite there because I want to keep growing and learning, and I read all the great people so I can continue to grow and learn.
Your reputation certainly says that you are.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm curious, did you work for a public broadcasting when Tales of the City came out?
Yes, it was already funded when I was at CPB. I remember that series well, though. I enjoyed watching it. It was a good series, wasn't it? In fact, I watched on some cable thing, it's COVID-19, so you can dig deep and watch all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. I watched the first episode of it again just a couple weeks ago.
Well, I was asking because that was a pretty scary time after that came out for public broadcasting.
It was. It's scary every funding year, actually. Almost every administration, every Republican administration, threatens to defund public broadcasting, but the people who enjoy it always beat that effort back, and I hope they continue to do things. I funded, for instance, a documentary called, I think it was called Brother Outsider, that was about Bayard Rustin. I was part of the group of leadership in public broadcasting when Tongues Untied was out, Marlon Riggs' documentary. So I hope I helped in my small way as an insider in public broadcasting to bring some of those programs to light.
Well, now is the time in the show called Awkward Question Authors Get. And what I do is I spin the wheel. Okay. And we get a question that people ask that sometimes are difficult for us to answer or confusing to get, or sometimes they're blunt and sometimes they're downright rude.
No, goodness. I'm glad I'm in Detroit, Brad.
So hang tight while I spin the wheel here. Okay, well, yours is, you'll hear what it is.
Okay.
How come I've never heard of you?
Ah, that's a great question. You've never heard of me because, publishing is a tough business, and writing crime fiction is hard because there are so many authors writing so many books. Some of it is really high quality and some of it is not. So there are lots of mystery titles around. We are a genre, considered a genre, not literary fiction. So sometimes it has to be a person who really comes to love the genre. You've loved Nancy Drew or Sherlock Holmes in your youth, and so you read crime and crime fiction. there's romance is such a big deal in publishing, especially in lesfic. So you'll hear about those authors a lot more than you'll hear about mystery and crime authors. And, you know, people get a lot of their entertainment from television. So you may not have read a mystery book, but you'll see its adaptation on TV and thought you've read it. You know, you've seen Bosch and you've seen, you know, Sherlock Holmes, and you've seen Agatha Christie and all that stuff, but you may have never read any of those books. And that's why you haven't heard of me, and I'm doing my best to make sure you do.
Well, good for you, as you should. Well, speaking of Nancy Drew and Sherlock, what are the earliest novels that you can recall that made you think perhaps you'd like to be a writer someday?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even as a 12-year-old, I remember I watched Nancy Drew, but I really liked the Hardy Boys, probably because I'm gay. So I'm going like, wow, the Hardy Boys, they get to get in the trains and fly planes and stuff like that. So I really love that stuff. And then as I got a little bit older, high school, I certainly was drawn to Sherlock Holmes' work. I was drawn to a lot of the short stories of Edgar Allan Poe. And then as an adult, I began reading lesfic when I knew that I was a lesbian. And so I read works by Catherine Forrest, her Fine Kate Delafield mystery. I read, there were a couple of black queer mystery writers at the time, Nikki Baker, and I read her stuff, and I read Penny Nickleberry's stuff. And then I read also a straight but African-American woman crime writer, Barbara Neely. And I think when I read Barbara Neely and Sue Grafton, that's when I thought, damn, I want to write that.
Well, my next question is, why crime fiction? I think you just answered it.
Yeah, I've always liked solving puzzles. I like to be that person watching the mystery on TV and figuring out who did it before everybody else does. Mm-hmm. I like the deflection. If I pick up a mystery book and I can tell where it's going or who did it too early, you know, I don't enjoy that. So I really strive hard in mind to deflect as much as possible to keep people guessing and to have surprise endings a lot of times.
Yeah, I've said several times on this show that mystery readers are funny because they're dying to be able to solve the crime.
Yes.
They're absolutely furious if they do.
That's right. It's really a disappointment. You have to hang your head for a couple of days.
Is there a novel or novelist that was the catalyst to make you take the plunge?
I think it's probably Sue Grafton, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I loved her Alphabet series. I loved Kinsey Millhone as a protagonist. I remember a friend of mine introduced me to it, and I read them religiously when they came out, and I just felt a great comfort in her and her gaggle of characters and friends, even though she was a straight woman. I really enjoyed reading the number one Ladies Detective Agency books. Those inspired me all along. So I'd leave it at those two.
Okay. Well, I Sue Grafton was one of my favorites as well.
Amazing.
What does literary success look like to you?
I had a conversation with a couple of friends at Saints and Sinners 3 years ago. And I said to them, you know, I'm going to feel like I'm a success when my book is in that revolving wire stand at the airport bookstore. You know, you can win all the awards and everything, but you know, when people are about to get on the plane and they walk in the bookstore and they get their bottle of water and their gum and their candy bar and get a book and it's yours, that's success to me.
That's awesome. So it's not crime fiction, but I'm intrigued. Can you tell us more about Long Way Home, which yes. I mentioned in the intro that you wrote?
Yes. That was a labor of love. Right after I started writing that before I left public broadcasting. And then when I took the early retirement in earnest, I finished it up. But it took about 7 years to write. I was intrigued by a documentary that was on public broadcasting called The War by Ken Burns. And when I looked at it, I realized that depiction of the Negro soldier, they called them Negroes in 1943, really wasn't the one my father had hinted about. And so I went about researching what it looked like for the Black soldier in World War II. I did some oral histories with both men and women soldiers. I did a lot of research at the Library of Congress. And I wanted to write about the 85 or 90% of them, Brad, who didn't go to the front lines. And that was the Negroes' experience in World War II, because it was a segregated army. And it was really a hardship for Black soldiers in those days because of the outright prejudice and outrageous treatment. So in my research, I conceived of the protagonist, Leroy. I have two protagonists, a man and a woman, so both soldiers, as being probably gay and looking at joining the army as a way to escape his small hometown. And as I was writing the book, I must have been two-thirds in, and I was awakened early in the morning by one of my secondary characters who said to me, literally in my ear, "You know I'm gay, right?" And I went, "What?" And so it changed the whole trajectory of the book. It was a secondary character, a sergeant, a hard-bitten sergeant preparing these soldiers to go to war, and it turns out he was gay. And so I told the story, his story as well. It became almost as important as the two protagonist stories. And I also told about his lover's story.
And you were awarded for that novel.
I was. I received the Next Generation Indie Book Award as the finalist in two categories, both the African-American literature category and historical fiction category. I was pleased by that. And I self-published that book.
And that was your first book?
That was my first book.
Oh, hooray.
Yeah.
Now, you were also named to the 2019 Hall of Fame of Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival.
What an honor that is.
I was going to ask you, tell us about that experience.
Well, it was, I called Paul, who runs the conference, to say, "Are you sure?" You know, he said, "Stop it, Cheryl." So I think he says this award is a combination of your writing and your work in the community. I've done quite a bit of work supporting the LGBTQ community. I was the vice president of what's called Black Pride here in DC for, I think, 5 years. It was a weekend, Memorial Day weekend, where 10 or 15,000 Black queer people came to DC to celebrate and to have community. And those were wonderful days. I made some outstanding friends who are friends to this day. I got to understand our community better. I got to understand the hardships of people who live in small towns and who can't be themselves. I learned about our trans community. I worked elbow to elbow with several trans folks who are friends. And so I did that work, and my volunteer work with Golden Crown, I think, was taken into consideration. So it was an honor to be named to the Hall of Fame at Saints and Sinners.
Certainly would think so. Now, you brought up with me before the ideal of balancing trends with truth.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I'll tell you what I specifically mean about that. My book three, each of the books, I was trying to challenge myself to write differently and better. So book two was a thriller. Book three, I really wanted to do something more insular that focused on a neighborhood in Detroit. I do love the city, and I love what it is intrinsically and what it has been historically. So I located the story in a place called Cass Corridor, which is this amalgam of students and ethnic students, and the medical center is there, and the Chinatown was there, and the drug dealers are there, and there's a vibrant music scene and a vibrant book and literary scene. And in that book, I had a trans woman character, and I wrote it in 2018 at a time when it was not popular for trans characters to die in the book. And yet I couldn't keep that character alive. I do let my characters talk to me, and this character wouldn't let me keep her alive. And so I knew that wouldn't be necessarily popular because of the trends, but I felt to be true to the story, and especially true to this character as I conceived of her and as she revealed herself to me, she died. She died in a way where she was honored by a lot of people for her courage and her smartness and all that, but I couldn't keep her alive.
That was an excellent definition of it. So you made it clear to me. And I agree with you. My characters speak to me, and sometimes I fight them. But they're always right.
Yeah, they are always right. You know, I'm going like, can I keep you alive? Do you have to go back into harm's way?
Now, have you ever been faced with the choice of whether to write what you want or make it marketable?
No, I have not yet. Oh, well, let me see. No, I have not yet. I will say the first mystery I wrote, which was a precursor to Charlie Mack, Charlie was not an out lesbian. I hadn't even thought about her as a lesbian because I think as I've said to you, Brad, I'm from that old school of noir, and you know, there's no romance in noir. You know, there might be some sex.
Yep.
So, Salem West, who's the publisher of Bywater Books, came up to me and said, I read your book. I like it. I said, great. She says, you think Charlie could be a lesbian? And I went, yeah, she could. You know? So I went back to my beta readers, and the good thing is they said, oh, we already thought she was. So I had to go about putting in a few romance scenes, which was very, 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 very difficult for me.
Yeah, romance scenes are hard for me as well.
Yeah.
And sex scenes are really hard for me.
Yes.
Well, what do you find difficult about crime writing?
You know, I think it's coming up with fresh stories because there are, as I said, so many books out there. I really don't want to replicate, and I don't want to be cookie cutter. So I'm looking for new takes on things. I know I'm not going to do a missing child thing. I mean, geez, there's, you know, that's everywhere. You know, I just don't want to do it. So I'm looking at new ways to think about, you know, crime and what happens in the bad nature of people, which is always there, and trying to push the envelope on that. So, you know, for instance, in book two, and I've never read a book about this. We have a big thing in Detroit called the Detroit Auto Show. It's an international audio show. More people, three quarters of a million people come to that weekend auto show. Week's worth of activities. And I thought, well, what would happen in Detroit if that auto show was under attack by terrorists? What would that do to the city? Who would be involved? Would they cancel the auto show? You know, what would that look like? And so I did a lot of research to write that as a thriller, because I really also love thrillers. And I don't know if anybody else would have written that book.
Well, I have an idea for you. What about a detective in a dusty office that has a bottle of alcohol in their bottom drawer?
Wow.
I don't think that's been done.
I don't think so too. And do you think a blonde mall should come in the office? With her hat cocked to the side?
Of course. Absolutely. Well, Cheryl, this has been a pleasure. I wish I had a longer show than a half an hour.
It's fun to talk crime stuff with you. Oh, it's knowledgeable.
I've enjoyed it very much. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. And congratulations for your recent honor. I think, what, top 10 best queer podcasts or something like that?
Oh, it was top 5.
Oh, my old. Who's counting? Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And maybe we'll have again when you get your next book out.
I would love to do that. And maybe I'll see you around too at some of the conferences after coronavirus.
I would like that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.